Mr. James, Reel 38. You told me off the tape a story about the an incident at the CEO's house. Could you describe that?
In the CEO's house?
With the guard and so on.
Oh, yes, well, every night. Companies in turn had to provide a very smart guard to guard behind their quarters through the night. And they would mount the guard at about 6:30 p.m. And the companies took turns to provide the guard for Britannia Quarters, the syndicals house in the village. In the syndicals house was a very beautiful looking Italian house, as a matter of fact, with sort of shrubs all around it. It was the best house in the village, and the CEO accommodated that for Britannia Quarters and for his own quarters as well. And so there was a guard mounted every night about 6:30. And now the guard would leave the company lines, having been inspecting the company lines, you know, the brass is polished and blank and all sort of thing. And the chaps who would even pass through temporarily would be nominated for guard duty, as well. It is quite a simple sort of the informing them is belt black coat. And you provide blank over that, and bayonet, belt and bayonet, and rifle. But the KD would be washed, you know, we'd expect them to sort of have a smart, clean KD. And for the evening, of course, the shorts were abandoned, it was long trousers at night because of the mosquitoes. So an increase in his trousers. Anyway, the guard was inspected the companies, and then he would marched up to mount the guard at Britannia Quarters in the town. Well, you could hear them going up, left, right, a smart body of men, you see, with the guard commander. And the duty officer of the day would be up there waiting, and the duty sergeant of the day would be up there waiting as well to see if everything was sort of done properly. And one night, you were marching through the village, right, very, very smart. And out from the bedroom window came a bucket of sewage. Just as we were passing it, and all over the guard. Well, you can imagine the scatter, the language, and all this sort of thing. He was terrible, he was there. Heinous crime. So, the matter was recorded immediately with the colonel. Summoned everybody who was available in all the companies to go up straight away. And we found the chap who did it, and he said he didn't know that the guard was passing by, but of course he must have known, and it was deaf. He must have known, and it was woeful. It came out right over the guard as he was passing up. The bloke was arrested, and we called him the Carabinieri, and he was given the Carabinieri. But what we did then, we made everybody there and then dig. They had no liquids of any kind, you see. And they sent sewage in buckets to be collected by an old hag of a woman who had a big iron tank with wheels on it, drawn by two oxen, once a week. Can you imagine what's been storing in the house in the bucket for a week? So, anyway, this sewage used to be disposed of by this old hag down in the big house. And there's a different story. She tried to get the sewage poured on the grapes in my company, but
you've mentioned that
story. But anyway, we made everybody dig a little, dig a hole in the back garden. It wasn't, there was an earth behind the house. And everybody from that day on had to have a deep enough hole where they could sort of use as a latrine in their back garden. There were lots of protests, but it happened, and that was the penalty they paid.
Were there any outbreaks of disease and so on during
this
day?
Yes. In that particular village, there was a rabid dog. And somebody had rabies, and we were very concerned about that. And there was an outbreak of rabies in the village, you remember that. The dog was destroyed. Fortunately, none of the British people contracted it, but there was a big alert about rabies. Also, typhus. Typhus is caused by mice. And you'll find the women of the village out in the front of the house at all times of the day and night, looking through the heads of their children, clucking mice. So we had to get them some DDT powder, and they were given some DDT powder, you know, because we knew when we explained to them the importance of not having any mice. Incidentally, there was an outbreak in Naples of typhus, a very serious outbreak as well. And we supplied troops, which we were called for. There was a big anti-typhus operation carried out in Naples, California. There were lots of deaths of typhus. The whole of the population had come out of the pavement, and the British troops, drawn from many units, had to give them a puff up the clothes and down the neck with DDT. And I was on that, and I often think, now DDT is banned in this country, it's going to be very, very dangerous. But we breathed in this powder all day long.
Can you describe that day? Yes, what was going on? Where
I was, anyway. All the women were brought out, and they were told that they were going to have this powder put on their clothes and down their blouses and on their heads. And this DDT powder would be killing mice. And this typhus epidemic had to be beaten. And they allowed the British Army to use DDT and disinfect them.
So what would be your party of men, and how would you set up this post?
There were medical teams, of course, issuing their orders, and they were puffing. They were puffers that the troops had, and they had to just put their hands under the women's skirt and puff the DDT up, and it just came up. Oh, powder was everywhere. And down their blouses, and there were, there was sunlight. In Naples, it was sun every day, and they were apparently disinfested of lice.
So how long were you, how long would this duty, for yourself, how long would you?
I remember particularly, I was there for a couple of hours, and I was trying to get away from breathing in the DDT.
So you went from the camp to Naples,
yes,
on this duty?
On this, that's right, on this particular duty, one day.
What about, like sexually transmitted diseases and so on? Was there, if a soldier contracted one of these diseases, what would the armies, how would you deal with that? Would you be involved in the
discipline? We had the RMO was a dapper little Irishman. His name was O'Hagan, and he had his medical tent, and I can see that. I forget the name of the sergeant that he had, but I can see him now, and he had his staff as well. And so there was a medical tent, a very important part of our activities there, this MO and the medical tent. There's a morning medical parade, MO's parade. Anybody wanted to report sick had to tell the company the night before they wanted to be sick. Every company had a sick book, and the sick book would have contained the names of the company personnel who were reporting sick. And we would go down to the MO with the ordinary sergeant. And after the MO's morning inspection and activities, he would fill in the sick book what was wrong with each person. And if it was something serious, it would be a medic. And also, as well, if it was something serious, it would come back. Private so and so has got suspected BV. You have to come back to the small kit, we would be going to hospital, and we wouldn't know what he was. So that we'd mark him in our register as in a hospital, and we'd be going to the Naples hospital, and they'd be sent to Naples, to the big hospital, and they'd vomit on in Naples, and they'd be there for some days, and then they'd come back, and they they were under surveillance for 6 months as well. They were with us. They went to the forward to the battalions. This information went forward to the battalions as well. And that was a very, very frequent thing, which is why we were intent on capturing as many of these shady women as possible who were living about, you know, in the fields and round about the camp doing business.
And so the soldiers would be trading food and cigarettes and so on for sexual favours.
Well, the soldiers were given condoms. There were condoms issued if they wanted them and all this sort of thing. And they also did tubes of ointment as well, which they could use immediately before or after contact.
So the army had to acknowledge the fact that this was going on.
The army, it was a very real thing. You get an army anywhere, and you get women everywhere. It's a problem, and it is one of the things that the army tries to combat.
You talked earlier about how in your duties at the IRTD that. Some soldiers would insult the staff to in a bid not to be sent up to the line. Would there be examples of people deliberately trying to contract an illness for the same reason?
Well, I don't know about trying to contract diseases like that. I mean, if they wanted to contract diseases like that, they'd be fools because some diseases are worse than others. But they would certainly employ some of the troops. Some of the some terrible characters would do anything to be put in the charge or put in the charge to get everybody back to the front line. Mm-hmm. And we were aware of this.
Were there any other ploys that spring to mind?
We were aware of the fact that they were trying to sort of avoid being on that truck. It's only half a mile road. We'd be wise with it. We would ensure that those chaps who try to pull out all the stops and try to sort of be kept back wet. And we'd say, "You're going, but we'll remember you should you come here again."
Did you ever encounter men where you thought that they shouldn't be being sent back due to their appearance or their mental condition?
Full authority to assess whether they were fit or otherwise, whether they should be sent back or otherwise. There was once, I remember particularly one case, there was a chap called McCormack. He was an Irish chap. And he was a borderline case. We thought, well, you know, but we sent him. We included him in the draft. And the news came back that he was killed that very day that he arrived at the new unit. We were wondering, we were really very sorry about hearing the news of McCormack having been sent up. And but we cut ties when we were told they wanted everybody, every man possible forward. Because, you know, of the shortage and the heavy casualties especially the Anzio time, some chaps went up there, but perhaps, I'm sorry to say it, perhaps they should not have gone.
In what way was McCormack borderline? What was?
I don't think he was quite fit. His fitness, mainly.
What about so-called bomb-happy, shell-shocked cases? Did you encounter those?
Bomb-happy, shell-shocked chaps, of course. Everybody was in action. There are many psycho cases, I can tell you now. Many psycho cases. And you live with it somehow.
How would a psycho case, how would that manifest itself in a man?
Well, their peculiar behaviour, not shaving and not having the upper wits about them. And
could you pick those men out?
Of course, in the IRTV, we sometimes left it to the units, you see, because we had to take them on. We tried to assess them fairly. We had to train them. No man should go forward if he wasn't fit. And the MO came in as well. We had to go by his judgment, you know. If we had to call for as many men as possible to go forward, we would say to O'Hagan, you know, we have to go by your report and give it to you.
What would your assessment, how would your assessment work?
We would know that the chap had come out, he's been in convalescence in the hospital, he's come to us after sort of a severe wound, you know. Are you sure your leg's all right? Yeah. You know, we wouldn't send a limping man, for example. I mean, if a man was obviously so badly wounded, ex-hospital, come to us. The medical, Hillhaven would deal with it, and he would ensure as well that chap would get the correct medical sort of advice and treatment, you know, or report. And we only sent forward, to the best of our knowledge, fit men. Other men, even at the IRTV, had to go to medical boards, and there were. Messages. We had the jocks, the AS, Argon and some of them, the Cameron Highlanders, the KUSBs, and the sending all the various Scottish regiments. They knew as well that the base held their men, and they would sometimes come down and visit.
Do you have any specific memories of that happening?
Only one or two. Really speaking.
Could you describe that?
There was one very young chap who was 18, and somebody came down to talk about him, and he was kept back as well.
Did they want him to come up?
He was very young, one very young. He looked under 18, you know, he was a young soldier, and I forget his regiment now, but he was a Scottish regiment with a red and white sort of dice thing, you know.
Did his unit want him to come back, or did they want him to stay? What was their attitude, the man from their unit that came back, the officer? You said that in this incident, someone from the unit came back.
That's right.
Did they want him to come back?
They came down and see this chap was 18, and we sort of talked about him. You know, and he was kept back a little while.
But what was their position? Did they want him to come back?
Well, they were mainly interested as well because they knew that he was there, really speaking.
Did you have any kind of psychiatrists or, you know, any kind of mental health professionals?
Not at the IRTV. Those psychiatrists were in Eccles.
As the war went on, there was lots of kind of ex-artillerymen transferred into the infantry. Did you have any experience with that? Were they coming through?
Well, I remember particularly, if we were transferred to the infantry, when the artillery and the ATAC units were obsolete and not required any longer, they were retrained and they were posted to where they wanted to go. And there were certain chaps, if they elected the cabinet for the Scottish regiment, they would sometimes claim siblings' rights. They would come XRA volunteered for ANSH, for example. And that was, you know, that's the, it was part of Jed Alexander's organization and rule, headquarters, GHQ arrangement. So, you know, it's quite normal. And there's no problem.
And did these men come through the...
One or two, as far as I can remember, when the ACT Act was not required any longer, but as we know, dismembered. But, I mean, I know one case in the Dunham's in the 60s, but I would call it one. Corden was ex-ACAC, and because he had a brother in the Dunham's infantry, I know that he volunteered to become a member of the 16th DLI, and he was gladly accepted. And he was found a position, but he was ex-ACAC, and he wasn't a fully trained infantryman. I think he was put the MT. You know, there's always a place for somebody.
As the war went on and casualties continued, did you notice a decline in the quality of the troops, or did it stay the same?
I mean, we took it for granted that reinforcements would come out from England. It was all sea, all ships in those days. There was no air freight. We'd be aware that there'd be another draft arriving next week, the ship, you know, and no, they were trained. They were younger, and they were inexperienced. Off you could tell they had white knees. You know what I mean? You could tell somebody fresh out of England anyway. You have to go to these brown, and if you say, you know what I mean? And, so, but you knew that they were once called up, you know, in 1943.
So they were quite a bit younger then.
That's right. Oh, yes.
Did were you involved at all in any kind of orientation talks or to when they arrived? Because they'd been a new country.
Not really. They arrived to go to their regiments, and they were sent accordingly to the company in the IRTD relative to their regiments.
If going back to the black markets, did you ever encounter the special investigation branch? Were they involved at all with the police?
Yes, that's right. They were called military police, you see, really. And I don't know where they were. Whether they were children or where, but they were somewhere, not very far away. But they were all very, very much tied up with the Italian Carabinieri police. That was a semi-military. They were all armed in the Carabinieri, and you would sometimes sort of be aware that there's an SID member of the Carabinieri's, and there was something going on in the area. And if you wanted some assistance, we should get a request once or twice. And they actually, the Southwest, incidentally, of sergeants, when they go, they attempt to get their rifles and go and assist them.
They would always ask for sergeants.
As I did. Yeah, once. Mm.
In the story that we've
yeah. That's right. It was, you knew that there was an armed bandits about, and that they were active in the area, and they were asked to. Or help in the one evening, in particular, when they were trying to round up this armed gang.
Oh yeah, we've talked about that already.
Yeah, right.
Were they involved in police and the army staff as well? Would there be cases of them investigating members of your colleagues?
Yes, they would. That's right. There was a liaison between the British. British security, SIB, and the Italians all the time, particularly there was a little village south of Paris called Arpaia, and that was where the prison was, and the Carabinieri, and these shady women, incidentally, were taken down to Arpaia. Please jump, oh dear. Terrible rats as well in the prison, didn't care about vermin. They were all verminous, awful places. But the Carabinieri were in the village We know what's called Pyrenees. Ubre Pyrenees, our Pyre. And it's on the map. And I remember that was where the SIV and Company NA's activities were.
But you didn't have any, there was no.
I went down to that police station once or twice with the RSM. RSM Ricks was the chap. And he said, come on, Jimmy, I want you to come with me today. Something interesting, you know. And he definitely told me that I'd be next in line for promotion. RSM Ricks, he was a South Staff Regiment. He was the RSM of 6th Battalion IRTD.
What kind of man was he then?
He was a bullshitter. He had a loud voice. Every enemy down at the double, and he would do this to CSMs. Come on, double! And he was a bully. Only because I think he was showing off, really. You know. And then he was eventually, he told me anyway that I was being groomed for number one. If anything happened to him. But something did happen to him. Coincidentally, another RSM called RSM Johnson from his old regiment, the South Staffs, came and took his place. So that must have been
So what happened to him? What did happen to him?
Yeah, I don't know. He was posted on. He wasn't a youngster. He wasn't a youngster. But although he was a bullshitter and in a very loud voice, and his bark was resonant like bite. I was amused more than anything. Rather frightened of him. And when he asked me to double, I said to him, oh, no, come on. You don't mean me, double. And, but anyway, he was a character. I must say that. He was a character, and he was a very colourful character.
Were there any other members of staff that maybe we haven't talked about
there were quite a lot of characters there. Quite a lot of characters. Some of them were getting on. There was a red-nosed jock from the Royal Scots who was a real Scots-looking bloke. Liked his whiskey. And he was a character. I don't think his name. He was a Scottish name. He wasn't a tapestry, but I remember him. He was a character. He really was a character. Lots of them were characters, as a matter of fact. There was a guards, RSM, who I don't know how he happened to be there, but he was a spare, and he was another character.
And all of these men would be downgraded?
All downgraded.
And so they'd have
downgraded on A1X, a lot of them, A1X, over 40, and past it really for some time.
Would any of their disabilities be obvious? I mean, did you have like men that couldn't that had a limp or used a stick? Or
well, the company commander, he walked with a stick and up and down with one day shoulder on the other, and he had had an injury, I suppose. And that was one example. Oh yes, there were quite a number of who had obvious wounds that were serious and they'd recovered from them. Oh yes, I must say, the rule was that one had to be downgraded. A fit man wasn't allowed to be there. And GHQ at Casertali made sure of that, you know. And there were directives from time to time as well. You know, one had to obey the rules.